The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
We talk about the music of poetry. The concept isn't really new, and yet sometimes the music residing in poetry is merely implicit, embryonic, the germ of a musical idea, but without a developed melody, rhythm, or other conventional musical forms. Which is why it sometimes takes more than just reading for the music of a poem to find full expression.
Con sombras necias, con indicios vanos, pues ya en líquido humor viste y tocaste mi corazón deshecho entre tus manos.
Hello, I'm Marcus Smith, thinking aloud today with an interpreter of poetry who has used his interdisciplinary expertise, expertise in language and literature, as well as musical know-how and ability, to take poetic interpretation in a fully musical direction. We'll enjoy poetry crafted long ago, centuries ago, poetry that has found new life just recently in musical reincarnation.
Baste ya de rigores, mi bien, baste. No te atormenten más celos tiranos, ni el virrecelo, tu quietud contraste. Con sombras necias, con indicios vanos, pues ya el líquido humor viste y tocaste. Mi corazón deshecho entre tus manos.
Our guest on Thinking Aloud today is Russell Clough. He's a professor at BYU, professor of Spanish, born and raised in Mexico. He has a master's degree in Spanish from BYU and a PhD in Spanish from the University of Illinois. His area of expertise is Latin American prose narrative, which is interesting given the fact we're going to talk a lot about poetry today. He has an emphasis on recent American fiction, which is also very interesting given the fact that we're going to be dealing with a poet from back in the 1600s. Anyway, Russell Clough has published over 20 articles on Latin American literature. His extracurricular interests include playing guitar, singing, collecting music, and composing. Russell Clough, welcome to Thinking Aloud.
Thank you.
This is a great project, and I've enjoyed listening to the music. We've had a chance to hear a short excerpt. While that's still fresh in our minds, why don't you tell us just a little bit about that particular piece?
That particular piece is one of her favorite poems. Anytime people download me on the internet, that one always goes into the group because it's a poem that says I met you this afternoon, and you treated me thus and so, and my heart was in your hands, and then it was broken and fell away. And this is a nun speaking in the 1600s.
A nun?
A nun.
By name? We haven't mentioned her name yet.
Her name is Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, Sister Inés de la Cruz, who was a child prodigy and read her father's library by the age of 13, her grandfather, that is, and was then asked to come into the viceroy's court in Mexico City, because this was not Mexico. This was at the time New Spain, and she wrote occasional poetry for everything that happened around there. And she didn't know that everybody else couldn't speak while they versified.
Tell us, if you would, because this is a name that's not going to be known very well to most in our audience, tell us about her stature in the literary canon of Mexican literature. Is this a big name?
This is the biggest name. We recently have a Nobel Prize winner by the name of Octavio Paz, and he tipped the scales towards the yes votes on that occasion because he had written a big book on Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz's poetry. It's called The Traps of Faith, that is the kind of stature that she has. Some people say she's the best of all Latin American poets, and I happen to agree with that.
But you talking about the best, meaning not just within her generation, not within the Baroque period, but to the present time?
Well, we have three Nobel Prize winners, Gabriela Mistral, Pablo Neruda, and Octavio Paz, who are all poets. They all read her. They all take from her. But to fix her a little bit better back in her own time, she followed Góngora and Lope de Vega and Quevedo, the great Baroque poets of Spain. But she fits right up there with them. She's as good as they are. And I find that she's more musical than they are.
Is her work as a poet the kind of thing that students today at universities can really chew into? And then, the second question is there any popular regard for her, apart from the world of the universities, in Spanish-speaking countries? Then?
Yes, she becomes more important by the day. She shows up in music like this. She shows up in movies. They've made movies about her. And of course, all of these media had to come about before they could do this. But, she is taught in all survey courses of Latin American literature. So anybody who takes a third year survey of Hispanic American literature is going to know Sor Juana. Now, she's a Baroque poet. And she's what they call a conceptista, one who writes in conceits. And therefore, this means complicated ideas with the hyperbaton that changes the syntax. And it makes the language quite thick, and students have to work in order to own the meanings of her poetry. But one who will stick with it will come away understanding her themes. They're surprised by the fact that they're love themes, and this is a nun, but there's a lot of history behind that to explain that sort of thing. For one thing, women were not allowed to do theology, and as a matter of fact, she did do that once, and it cost her freedom.
In what way did it cost her freedom?
What happened is that I believe it was the Bishop of Puebla asked her to make a comment on a speech having been given 40 years before by a Portuguese Jesuit. She wrote such a fine piece of theology that it's totally apprehensible today. You can totally read it and understand that she knew the Bible backwards and forwards, and that she was better than the Jesuit priest who was famous for his oratory. And then at that point, there were two viceroys and their wives that had supported her during her short career. She only lived 44 years, who had moved on, and a new viceroy was to come. And in the meantime, the Bishop of Mexico was the acting viceroy, and he and her confessor told her not to write anymore. And this was 2 years before she died in an epidemic.
So the loss of her freedom was essentially, she was censored.
Yes, she was. And that's one of the poems that we have here called En Perseguirme Mundo, When You Persecute Me, World, what is your interest? And that's her defense before the world to be able to explain to them why she wanted more than anything else to learn and to write. And this is her defense before the world.
Well, as long as you brought that title up, let's listen to it. And then we're going to talk a little bit about what got you going on this project, where you would take these old pieces of poetry and then give them fairly modern musical settings.
Thank you.
The title of this piece again that we're going to listen to?
En Perseguirme Mundo.
Así siempre me causa contento.
That's not the kind of music that Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz would have been familiar with in her day.
No, she said that that guitar and a tabor were used for some of her music that was presented in the cathedral. But what I tried to do was to pick instruments of that period. And then I also realized that if I'm going to have any chance at all of having a popular audience pay any attention to this music, It needed to be a little bit more modern. Therefore, I picked modern rhythms, but the chord systems are clearly Baroque.
You've hinted at something just a second ago, the idea that in her day, some of her texts would have been performed as music,
right,
as songs.
Right. Now she was a genius in all senses. She knew music. She knew art. She knew mythology. She knew the scriptures. She knew whatever science was extant at the time.
Apparently she knew human relationships, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is what shocks everybody, that she had a very unfortunate life. Her mother was never married, and her mother had something like 6 children. And this is one of the reasons why she never had an opportunity to marry and why she chose not to marry, because if she had, she would have had to marry way down. And at the time, that meant lots of things. For one thing, she would have never been able to read or write. Her time would have been taken up totally.
Tell us, if you would, is this collection, then, how big is it? Does it deal exclusively with this poet? And are you the sole composer involved here?
Yes. This particular project has 14 songs in it. All of them are sonnets except the last one, which is called a romance, which would be like a ballad. The difference is that the sonnets have 11 syllable verses, and the romance has an 8 syllable verse, and it's able to move faster. This is called Volume 1, and I did that on purpose so that I would do Volume 2. And there is nothing here that is not Sor Juana's. And Volume 2 will also be Sor Juana's, but I might take 2 or 3 of these and have women sing them and put them in the new album.
But they're all original musical compositions.
And they're all original musical compositions. I got the inspiration to do it because I was invited to go to California, UC Santa Barbara, to help celebrate all of the J artists of Mexico. This would have been Juan José Arreola, and in that list, and it would have been Juan Rulfo, and it would have been Juan García Ponce, and in that list was Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And I thought, well, this is the time that I should do what I've wanted to do practically all my life. I left music here at BYU and went over to the David O. McKay building to study literature, and I never left music behind. I always played the guitar and kept singing. And over there I had discovered that one of those poets from the Golden Age, his plays were full of sonnets and the sonnets were full of music, and I did one for a class. So I'd had this in the back of my mind all this time, and then I thought, well, this is the time that I can pay homage to Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz by doing a couple of songs. I started doing the first song, and it came out extremely fast. I did a second one, and I said, wait a minute, this is bigger than this. I'm not going to go down there just with a guitar and sing these raw songs. I'm going to do this one right. And that's what got the whole thing started. And so I composed each song, then I looked for somebody to record, and I looked for the musicians to back me up. And also, Brian Jensen, a graduate from BYU's music school, is the arranger.
If you would, I wanted to chew on the question of text and music and what you've learned in bringing your music to these texts. There's always a little bit of a tension between what's going to win the day. Is the music paramount? Are the words paramount? But what kinds of things have you grappled with and what have you learned in the process?
Well, I've learned lots of things. And one of the things was that I started looking into Baroque music and I discovered that a certain Italian by the name of Caccini is the one who really got Baroque music rolling. And he established certain parameters for it, and one of these is monody, a single melody by a single instrument. Okay, but then they started adding in other instruments that were becoming popular at the time, and his number one point was the text over the music. Now, this is new because those medieval singers would force words into slots that they didn't belong in. And there was too many voices for people to really pick out what they were saying. And so this is the beginning of the popular song, really.
So the idea is then that you preserve the natural cadence, the natural way the lines would scan as poetry, so that they're recognizable.
Above all things, my goal was to make every syllable understandable and to never stress a word where it should not be stressed.
In some ways, this is ideal for having some cultural material to use in language acquisition causes.
Right. That was part of the idea. I realized also that I learned the poems much better once I understood them as songs.
And what accounts for that?
I have no idea why music helps poetry come to the fore, but you know that all of our students have their iPods and they all live by music and they know the words.
In some ways, though, when you superimpose or subimpose music with a text, you are interpreting and you are going to put in the foreground with emphasis certain syllables or certain ideas above others. You have to make those choices.
Right, right. In this album, certain of these songs will feel a lot more Baroque than others, but each poem has a mission. For instance, she has a song about Pilate, and how Pilate made the wrong judgment, and nobody has ever forgiven him for it since. And when he made the judgment on Christ, he made it on himself. Well, that kind of a poem needs a different kind of music. And I made a death march for that one, because in studying the life of Christ, it dawned on me one time after a lot of years of reading through what really happened, was that it was the temple guards that came to the Mount of Olives and took Christ. And I said, now, wait a minute. And that threw me back to the notion that Christ was really killed because he cleansed the temple, because he took away the money from the Sanhedrin and the priests, because they sent their guards to pick him up, and they took the guards to Pilate, who was Roman, and when he finally washed his hands of the situation, he turned them over to Roman guards, and that's the way I made the song, as if it were a military death march going up the hill to Golgotha. So the poems talk to you. And then there's another one called, it's the Pyramus and Thisbe story, which is the Romeo and Juliet story. Ovid found the story in the culture of Babylon, and he wrote it up for us. Then Shakespeare picks it up, and Sor Juana, who was born, say, you know, just a few years after Shakespeare was dead, she writes the story too. But she leaves the original names, and then this motif is just played over and over and over through popular art and everything else.
That's not going to be a death march. Is
right. No, and this one is also a death song, because this is Thisbe leaving Babylon, and you have to think of those adobe buildings that they had, and you have to think of the fact that there were mulberry trees there at the time. This is actually Iraq, where Babylon is. There were mulberry trees at the time, which don't exist anymore. And that they are to meet at this mulberry tree, and she meets with a lioness, and the lioness gets her shawl and tears it to pieces. She runs off and hides. Along comes Pyramus, and he sees her shawl all over the ground, and he kills himself. She comes back, and she kills herself. So this story is told over and over and over. And on this one, I make sure that the tempo is down. I make sure that it's plodding, because I've heard these death marches during Holy Week in Latin America all my life. And so I have that plodding feel come into the song.
We're going to have to take some time to sample another tune. I just want to let those who are just tuning in know who you are. We have on Thinking Aloud today Russell Clough, and he has put together a collection of his own compositions, new settings, probably some in some instances the very first settings ever, I would imagine, of texts by the Mexican poet Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who lived from 1651 to 1695. The title of your CD collection is The Return of the Tenth Muse. I understand the Tenth Muse is a nickname for her.
It is. She had two nicknames, the Tenth Muse and the Phoenix of Mexico.
Let's give a listen to the tune that I have written down here as Rosa. The full title of that is actually...
Rosa Divina, Divine Rose.
Rosa divina, que en gentil cultura eres con tu fragante sutileza. Magisterio purpúreo en la belleza. Enseñanza nevada a la hermosura. Amago de la humana arquitectura. Ejemplo de la Habana gentileza. Ser unión naturaleza, la cuna alegre y triste sepultura. Cuán altiva en tu pompa presumida, soberbia. Riesgo de morir desdeña y luego desmayada y encogida de tu caduco ser das mustias señas con que conducta muerte, inercia, vida, viviendo, engaña y muriendo.
Russell Clough, tell us what this song's all about.
Okay, to begin with, she never put any titles on her poems, and so I use information out of the first line. This is why it's called Divine Rose. This poem is very, very Baroque and very much from the Baroque period because it uses the rose as a clock to talk about the human life. And it says that the rose is like human architecture, the human body, that that it's beautiful, it's arrogant, and it's ephemeral.
Yeah, I think from the Baroque period, I would think that there, one would focus on the transitory nature of our existence. We're going to die. Isn't that kind of
That's
a
right.
very important thing?
That's right. And therefore, take advantage of this life. Don't waste it, and don't be too proud, because you do have to keep your eye on the end.
Yeah.
The end is near.
Does that thematic material and the thematic material in the other songs still really feel compelling or relevant today? Are we so thoroughly modern that this is a bit antiquated, or that these texts might strike us as passé?
It could, but I don't find that to be true with the students that read and study the poetry with me. I do teach poetry, because any time I teach survey courses, it's all genres. So and so. To me, I don't know, but I guess, have you ever seen Hallmark? Have you ever seen how many roses show up on Hallmark? Yeah, roses are relevant.
Yeah. There's a timelessness, you would say, to the
text? I think so. I believe so.
Yeah. Is, is the popular feel of these melodies that you've created something that speaks to any particular audience today, or are you finding that it speaks to the young and old alike?
I would hope that it speaks to both, but I do know that people who are my age and older really, really key into it immediately. Any times when I've been singing a concert, I'll look down and all the 50-year-old women who speak Spanish are singing with me. They know this. They know these verses. They know the text.
And you've had obviously occasion to perform this in front of audiences that are not American audiences that speak English. But
we have an institute here called the Vallejo Literary Institute, and we have many of these functions.
As we conclude our conversation today, I'm hoping you can tell us just a little bit about the fact that there might be something that feels like the genre is ballad, from what I've been able to sample. Are these thoroughly balladic in their feel, the way you've set them?
I would have to say they are. But I tried, number one, to go through each sonnet without doing any games, no repetitions or anything. If you listen to one of these songs, you will get the entire sonnet before I start repeating or doing the things that turn it into a ballad.
Yeah.
But each strophe can talk to me and tell me this is the one that's going to be the chorus, or this is the one that's going to have the first difference from A to B, and then later on I'll come up with C in one of the tercets.
Yeah. And this is your voice. I failed to mention that. The what we're hearing in the background right now, as well as the piece we've just heard, that's you singing.
That's me.
You've got a marvelous instrument, a marvelous talent. There's a beautiful voice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Russell Clough, great pleasure having you on Thinking Aloud today to talk about your collection of songs that you have composed to texts by Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, Mexican poet from the 1600s. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Pues no le puede el odio haber ganado sin haberle perdido amor primero. Y si piensas que el alma que te quiso de estar siempre a tu afición ligada de tu satisfacción vana te aviso pues si el amor al odio ha dado entrada el que bajó de sumo a ser remiso de lo remiso pasará a ser nada
Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.